And that was Midnight Oil with, what's the name of that song? Blue Sky Mine. Blue Sky Mine. That's right. I love that song. I think I was dancing to that song in Paris way back in 1983. Wow, that's a great song. And thank you for playing that, Ear Buddies. Ear Buddies are on their way out. And you're listening to WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford, also known as 91.5 FM, Tufts Freeform Commercial Free Community-Based Radio. Also my favorite, Tufts Educational Radio. That's all of us here. And for the next 2 hours, slice that community-based socialist alternative radio, talk and music from a working-class democratic socialist perspective. Your host today is Jeff. I was possibly going to have Diego as co-host today, and I guess something came up. So you'll be listening to my voice, you'll be listening to music, you'll be listening to me talking about reading some other things from other people, etc. And if you're a regular listener, you know that we like to give a soundbite about what the show's about at the beginning, sometimes, often, just to let people know what they're in for. And we are part of, you know, a small but significant alternative radio voice in the country. Alternative media on the internet, which is much larger, podcasts, that sort of thing. Although this goes out live, you can listen to WMFO by going to WMFO.org on your computer, of course. Hit schedules, hit the show you want, shows are archived for at least 2 weeks. I wish they would increase that archival capacity. But anyway, what I was getting at is that this show, Social Alternative Radio, we are here for alternative information. We are here for sort of, you know, left-wing news, if you want to call it that, or something, although left-wing is such a vague term. But we're also here as democratic socialists, as you know, active socialists in a socialist movement, which may or may not be evident to you, and it's not your fault if you don't see it above ground, but it is there. And we are trying to get people interested in activism, you know, especially socialism, especially from using the tools that socialism provides to activists to keep them in the struggle for the long haul, to keep people involved in social justice way beyond single issue, way beyond the trends, the ups and downs, because the root of all social problems really are found in the economic system that generates and regenerates inequality and war, racism, sexism, fighting between people over resources to survive or to control from the ruling class, from the elites. And, you know, capitalism itself rests on two fundamental things: the exploitation of labor, you know, everything that you see that's manufactured, that's a commodity, a good, a service. Those are things that are worked on. They take work to do. Someone's got to do that work. Even if it's something that you think is automated, well, someone had to, you know, extract the raw materials for the machine that you see in an automated process. Someone has to maintain that machine. The minute you start a machine, it starts to depreciate in value, starts to wear down. Worn down parts must be replaced, et cetera, et cetera. Programming, the monitoring, the distribution of an automated process, that's all work. We're going to get into that today, actually. There's an interesting piece by, I believe it's Kim Moody from Labor Notes and other publications, who talks about how the capitalists have worked so hard to try to, within certain parameters, which I don't think he goes into in the article, but we can talk about, to eliminate the cost of wages. Which is ironic, because they get their profit really from exploiting labor, from paying less in wages than the value we create with our work. That's where their profit comes from. So in eliminating that, they're going to eliminate their own profits eventually through underconsumption, but also through the direct exploitation and extraction of surplus value. Both at the same time will be actually deadly for the system. But before there's some sort of, you know, total collapse or something, they'll just actually be new incarnations and new more vicious cycles of capitalist exploitation with more labor that they are saying they don't need, but they like having that army of surplus labor. I'm using surplus in a different way than I was a minute ago. They like having that army of surplus labor. But within those those things that will fail with capitalism, there is still the moment, which is what capitalists live in, the short-term maximization of profit, where they are exploiting labor and exploiting nature, ruining the environment for human habitation as the system grinds on. And that's the fundamentals of the system. So right there you have everything from, as you know, Marx started to write about when he first was writing, Karl Marx, alienation, people separated from control over their own labor, separated from the results of their labor. They don't own what they actually produce, they being working people. If you think that for 1 second Bill Gates owns a program or a computer or something, then you're not aware of the many, many numbers of people it takes to create thousands and hundreds of thousands. If you follow its distribution, it takes for a commodity to reach market, the so-called market under capitalism. So right from the start, the system is creating alienation, it's creating exploitation, inequality, unfairness, creating the conditions for a struggle for survival that is constantly actually killing people, making people ill, making people do everything to chase money and sell their labor. And this is the roots of the social problems that many people are taught to deal with only on a superficial level. Socialism gets at those, the roots of the problem, and calls for organizing for fundamental change. And that is, that's a very, very, that's extremely important and essential to social. Otherwise, you're just repeating the same social struggles under worsening and worse and worse conditions. And we want to see a world where there's equality, basically, where there is an equality. That doesn't mean sameness. Equality means everyone has a decent life. Everyone has not the sort of empty opportunity rhetoric, but the actual resources to achieve what they want to achieve in society, as part of society. And that's, you know, socialism is getting at the roots of the problem. It also provides possible solutions, not in a blueprint form, but in a general way that, hey, if all of a sudden the vast majority of people controlled the economy or economies around the world and could then democratically decide on what's going to be made, what goods and services are going to be made, how they're going to be made, excuse me, and how they're going to be distributed for human need and not for profit, that creates an entirely different world, one in which you can start to really work on the problems, work on solving the problems that capitalism keeps generating and regenerating. Doesn't mean all the problems disappear overnight, doesn't mean all the old prejudices magically disappear, but you have the tools then to, in terms of, to work on making them disappear, but more importantly, you have, excuse me, you have the groundwork laid where the tools can actually function and build a new society. Under capitalism, if you try to build a little enclave, a little island, and some people believe in this, a little, a cooperative of right-thinking people and so on. I mean, it's just, it gets engulfed. This has been tried many times since the beginning of capitalism. It gets engulfed by the capitalist system. It gets tainted. It gets taken over. It gets exploited in itself, or it becomes part of the exploitation in order to survive. And it won't survive for long even that way, most likely. So today's show, we're going to, as I maybe mentioned, we're going to be talking about some upcoming meetings regarding the Me Too and women's movement, the women's marches. What's the purpose of those marches? What's been happening with them? We'll be talking about, go back to that sort of general view of capitalism, what's some new statistics, new facts about the just the viciousness of the system right now, the inequality in some of the richest countries in the world, and still just vicious inequality, and in addition to that, that's mainly our main themes today. I might get into some other things. I'm sorry. We'll get into the Democratic Party. Interesting article by Arundhati Roy, whose work we really like, the NGOization of Resistance. And again, if you just tune in, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio on 91.5 FM. Tufts Free Forum Commercial Free Community-Based Radio, also known as Tufts Educational Radio, and that is, we're emanating from Medford, Somerville / Medford, around the border, kind of, Massachusetts. And if you are, and we do have international listeners because of the wonders of the internet, go to WMFO.org. And by the way, this was not a prepared part of the show. Actually, the show is, we prepare for some things, other things we kind of don't have time to prepare for, and we just figure we'll discuss them out on the air. But one thing I didn't prepare for, but I've been thinking about a lot, and I'm getting more information about this, is under the topic of net neutrality. So I'm just going to digress for a moment here. I actually heard someone in Social Alternative say that, you know, there's this, there's been published reports of Google diverting or slowing down access to left-wing websites. This has been a recurring thing. It's been out for, I think, months now, or maybe a little less than that, but it's out there. I haven't studied it carefully, but I was surprised to learn yesterday that people that are... people at Social Alternative that are helping to keep the socialalternative.org website going have said that that is in fact the case, that actually traffic has slowed to our website based on this Google slowdown. There's also the Facebook thing going on with, you know, putting up what they consider real news and limiting access to other sources, including, you know, a lot of left-wing sources, including they took down the English Télé Sur, sorry, I don't mean to put a French accent on, that's a South American television and media outlet that's left-wing. And sure enough, I got that on my news feed in Facebook, and I went looking for it, and you could find the Spanish version, but you could not find the English version. It was not, they had taken it down. So then on top of that, I get an email today. The campus police at Worcester State are harassing students there that are out leafleting for Socialist Alternative. Then you have and the campus administrators openly acknowledging the police don't like Socialist Alternative being there. They don't like the student club that's Socialist Alternative there. and then on the way in, I hear on the radio that Worcester State had some racist graffiti in the dorms. Yeah, I see a correlation there. Sorry, you know, if you're gonna have these, if you have these cops harassing people, that students that are just passing out leaflets about social justice issues, in this case, they're passing out leaflets about a public meeting at Worcester State, which the university has approved, about Me Too and the new women's movement, which I'll mention in a few minutes. I see a correlation there. If you're gonna harass us and people that are out there, you know, fighting for equality, and you know, people see that, hopefully, you know, students will react like, oh, the cops are harassing them, forcing them to leave an area that they're supposed to be, have free speech in and be able to leaflet. Why I should be interested in that. What are you guys leafleting about? And that did happen a little bit, but there's also, you know, unfortunately, some students and some people in this is in Worcester, Massachusetts, that are right wing and moving even further to the right, and they're going to see the cops, they're going to support whatever the cops do, they're going to say the cops are right no matter what, no matter what rights the cops are taking away, no matter what violence the cops are enacting on people of color and others, and that will, and they'll be like, yay cops, shut down another, you know, commie table or something like that, you know. And this is also, by the way, at a university where, you know, a lot of working class students go. It's doesn't have the greatest amount of resources, so there isn't the greatest extracurricular life there. It's mostly a commuter school, but there are live-in students, and you want to shut down a effort to get people to a talk by a speaker who is a feminist activist, who is a woman in the Building Trades Union, IBW, Local 103, and who has a lot to say, has been very active in the Me Too and women's movement that's emerging, that's been emerging, and are you going to shut that down? But the racist graffiti, that goes up there, you know, and there's a connection there, it's, you know, the state, the capitalist state, and its main goal of providing an uninterrupted, predictable, locked down environment for capitalism to grind on and chew up people's lives. That means defending people like Trump and Trump's basic existence and basic, from their point of view, legitimacy. So this gets into a point we make a lot. I'll make it here. I'll make it later, hopefully, if I remember, that right now a lot of activism is as in this often happens in American history, a lot of people that consider themselves activists that see liberalism as some sort of good thing, when actually it's just it's ultimately a defense of the system of capitalism. They're channeling people. They're trying to channel people, including the leaders of the Women's March that happened last week. They're trying to channel people into a view that the main thing that you could do, that you should be doing right now, is getting Democrats elected in 2018, right? And that is not the main thing people should be doing, because the Democrats, in many ways, are agreeing with some policies that Trump is putting forward. They are giving him cover in terms of considering him, normalizing him, or considering him legitimate in other ways. Look at that guy that just got elected in Mississippi, Olson, that ran ran against the odious Republican who was a child molester, maybe, allegedly, tried to pick up young girls, was just this horrible candidate, reeking of corruption and child abuse and so on, allegedly. And so the Democrats, somewhat predictably, not totally predictably, but somewhat predictably, won that election with a candidate named Olson. I forgot the guy's first name. And the minute he gets in, he's like, "Oh, Mr. Trump and I spoke on the phone, and I'm looking forward to visiting the White House someday soon. And no, Trump isn't an abuser of women the way the person he beat was." I mean, I don't even know if he acknowledged the person he beat was that way. It turns out Olson ran a conservative campaign, including an ad that invoked the Confederate and Union battlefield. And I think the message was, the need for bipartisanship or something, which is insane. An army supporting slavery needs to be defeated, not made an equal, that to make some sort of decision in a Congress. I mean, the analogy doesn't even work. And so this guy just was defending Trump, after he got elected. And defending bipartisanship and so on. And then you have another example of that through the DACA thing and the shutdown that just happened of the government, the so-called shutdown of the government here in the United States, where it turned into, at least the way the corporate media framed it, this showdown between the Democrats and Republicans, when in reality neither party has any sort of plan. They have no general amnesty in mind or any sort of real plan for migrant workers that are forced to come to this country because of the policies of U.S. imperialism around the world, economic and military, creating instability, creating the need for people to leave to survive or to try to get a better life where the pay might be higher and so on. So it came down to the Democrats, according to the corporate media narrative, they wanted to support DACA, keeping children of immigrants, the children who came here so-called illegally, and then being able to stay here, and they're calling it, the Dreamers and all this other propaganda about that. And these are the children of migrant workers, and of course they should be able to stay here. And they should be given full amnesty, and neither party is saying that. So predictably, the Democrats just caved on DACA to the point where a prominent immigrant rights activist, I wish I had this with me, I was going to bring it, I forgot her name, but she immediately quit the Democratic Party, put out a thing on Facebook under Movement for a People's Party, which we've talked about before, a third party movement trying to get Sanders and others to promote the need and get involved with the need and help build a third party for working people and youth that would not be run by corporate money and so on, like the Democrats and Republicans are. And she quit the Democratic Party after they caved on DACA over this past week. And then she went over to the Movement for a People's Party. And, you know, caving in on DACA, which is a minor reform, really. I mean, we support, you know, the reform, you know, the DACA reform, the DACA demands of these migrant, the children of migrant workers being able to have full citizenship and so on. But we take it much further, you know, for immediate full citizenship, immediate amnesty of not just the DACA recipients, but immigrants in general in this country. And that's happened before, by the way, under the Reagan administration. Go look it up if you want a further lesson in the duopoly in this country, you know, and the question of immigration, which we've gotten into before, which we'll just will carry the digression a little further here. Immigration, the reason that there's such confusion among the ruling classes, the ruling class and their political parties on immigration, is that they love exploiting immigrant labor. They divert, for the most part, I mean, almost entirely, penalties away from corporations that exploit immigrant labor and put the penalties onto immigrants themselves. Why the corporations love exploiting immigrant labor is because the threat of deportation gives them yet another way to terrorize workers. Corporations are in the business. They're extremely authoritarian institutions. They are in the business of doing whatever they need to do to control the workers. And at times where the workers' movement is well organized and gaining ground and unions are strong and maybe there's a workers' party if you're in certain countries, they're forced to give concessions. But it's only under capitalism, that is only temporary. When they can, they'll claw back to the top, unencumbered, or having weakened the unions or the political parties that ostensibly support workers or were supporting workers, and they will dismantle everything. And in this country, they're all the social gains, both economic and political. So they're dismantling. In this country, there's no accident that at the same time pensions are being destroyed, and wages are flat and stagnant. For example, 80% of the corporations that just got this tax cut, this tax gift of a cut from Trumpo, they've said openly they will not translate that into wage increases for their workers. 80%, and that's probably, and you know, that's such a joke of a survey in some ways, because if 80% are willing to openly say that, you know, it's like 99% are not going to give any pay increases to their workers. The way people get pay increases, this has been forgotten by a lot of people, not their fault necessarily, because the corporate media doesn't remind you of this, but the way people get pay increases through unions, that's how they get pay increases. And workers' parties that get in and increase the minimum wage and so on, they get pay increases through Socialist Alternative winning election of a socialist, Shama Sawant, to Seattle City Council, and making $50 an hour the main campaign, one of the main campaign goals, and very quickly turning the first election of Shama Sawant in 2013 into a movement for $15 minimum wage for Seattle workers that passed and was the first law in the country at a citywide level for a minimum for $50 minimum wage. No accident that when that happened, where you had a socialist, and only one, by the way, only one socialist on the city council in Seattle. And Shama then got reelected by a wide margin to Seattle City Council. And, of course, we're fighting on housing issues and other issues, rent control and so on. Anyway, back to the Democrats and the DACA and all that. So you have these basic things hardwired into the capitalist system. And one of them is the exploitation of immigrants. And this is why some capitalists will use immigration as a populist or right-wing populist issue to fool workers into thinking, oh, your problem is the immigrants coming in. They'll use cultural differences. They'll try to exacerbate them, try to make them seem like they're a problem, and then divert all the attention away from the real problem, the capitalist rulers, the capitalist bosses, their greed, their exploitation of our labor, and they'll transfer that to people that are just like us, you know, migrant workers, workers trying to survive, you know? So there are entire, of course, I mean, a lot of our listeners in the U.S. know this, but just, you know, we have U.S. international listeners, there are entire, of course, factories and workplaces where they're completely hired. It's all immigrant workers. Excuse me, often Latino workers, not always. And some American workers are native, I don't mean American, sorry, I mean native born, so-called, or whatever. They'll look at that and they'll be like, and even people of color, and they'll look at that and they'll say, well, what's going on here? I mean, I can't get a job there. It's all, they just keep hiring immigrants and a certain percentage of illegal, or maybe totally illegal, quote-unquote, immigrants. Now, first of all, that's not the immigrant's fault if they get hired, if they're trying to sell their labor and the boss is like, yeah, we like that. We like that illegal status. Boom, you know, we're going to use that. Or we'll look the other way and assume they're illegal or enough of them are illegal that if we threaten them with calling ICE or whatever, that's going to give us a big advantage. And it does often. But at the same time, there's brilliant examples of migrant workers here in the U.S. of joining the labor movement, of creating a lot of energy in the unions over the last 20 years, 30 years, and successfully organizing despite the threat of deportation. And that's still happening today. But what I was starting to say is that, you know, some workers, you know, if they don't look into it, if they're not discussing it with other workers, there's very little education really that happens in unions these days, or unions generate very little education, which is really unfortunate. And there's no workers' party in this country, no big socialist, communist, labor party. So the education can't happen that way. So that a lot of really backward ideas circulate among workers and don't get any kind of alternative explanation out there. So, for example, I see a workplace completely dominated from you know, my point of view. If I'm just walking around and see, I apply to get a job at a big workplace and I notice it's all worker for, you know, from my point of view, if I'm a native born American or whatever, which, you know, by the way, you have no control over where you're born. So makes the whole immigration thing even sillier in from a certain way, but a certain perspective. But anyway, so you're looking and you're saying, geez, you know, all immigrants working there, or who I think are immigrants, and I can't get a job there. What's going on? You know, oh, it's those immigrants. Well, it's not. They don't make the decision on hiring. And you have to understand, the reason they're hiring all immigrants or mostly immigrants is to have that extra club of deportation on top of the club of just, you know, firing someone and someone losing their livelihood and how scary that is, how weak the unions are now. In general, there are exceptions and so on. And the exceptions are plenty of places where immigrant workers and non-immigrant workers or immigrant workers themselves are able to overcome that fear that the bosses, the big bosses, the big corporations instill in them, the insecurity, and they do successfully organize into unions. They do successfully. And I've participated in it. I've seen it. And we can create, even under capitalism, for the short term at least, we can create jobs programs. We can create force companies to hire on a broader way. We can create jobs programs. You know, we could. They say there's full employment now. It's a lie. We could create, at least for a time, full employment, really, or close to it, really would take eliminating capitalism and having democratic socialism to really do that, but to have real everyone really working in jobs they want to work at, etc. But, you know, there is, even under capitalism, a long way to go. Well, long way is the wrong way to put it, but there are big, big areas of that, you know, reform could happen, at least temporarily. And that includes basic, you know, access to jobs. As long as that's in the hands of private companies entirely, then they will exploit immigration status and they will exploit racial and ethnic divisions in society. They'll do anything for a divide and conquer strategy. It works so well for them. They actually just sort of naturally gravitate towards that, even if they're not conscious of it. They're like, oh, if we get these people in, you know, then we'll control them better. They're not used to certain rights, so they think, so the bosses think, and we'll keep out the people that might give us problems. You know, we could take people in that are related to other people and try to, you know, it's all, you know, networks, methods of control. you know, I'm aware of a certain factory operation now where they have this older guy who runs around. He's like a thug for the big bosses, and he runs around and terrorizes a lot of workers, a lot of immigrant workers, into working forced overtime, into showing up at shifts they were not originally called in for, and so on. And this is his whole job. So, you know, and actually every supervisor, every human resources person is really just a cop for management, by the way. Keep that in mind. Don't have any illusions in them. Anyway, I just want to get back into the main some of the main themes here. Now, before we get into the women's movement and the march last week and so on, there is a thing that Socialist Alternative is in political solidarity with the Committee for Workers International. And in Sudan, there is a new group of supporters of the Committee for Workers International. And it's interesting because I had an interview years ago with a young person from Sudan. And I went going into the interview, I thought, you know, we're going to be talking about the left in Sudan. He was completely ignorant of any left wing existing in Sudan, had no knowledge of it whatsoever. And that's a shame because we, you know, in America, we assume that the left is bigger in every other country. And we're very excited about that. And as, you know, a starting point, you know, at least, you know, we understand why. Through the history of the United States, why the left is relatively small, but that's changing now, you know. But I hate to see other countries where, you know, you assume there's some sort of socialist movement. I guess we shouldn't assume. And then you find out people are ignorant about it, or they're misleading you, one or the other. When immigrants come to this country, and I was interviewing an immigrant from Sudan, there's often a disconnect based on cultural differences and so on, where, you know, what they knew as left-wing in their country just doesn't seem to translate here too much, especially if they're not really involved in socialist politics here. but now I'm pleased to see that there is a left in Sudan. I didn't do the research at the time. And there is a CWI. There are CWI supporters. There's Committee for Workers International. Go to socialistworld.net for more information on this, by the way. This is from an article on socialistworld.net from January 22nd about Sudan, entitled Sudan Free Mohamed Sati and All Political Prisoners. CWI supporter Mohamed Daildin Mohamed Sati, he's 21 years old, known as Hamoudi, is among the protesters who have been arrested by the Sudanese state last week as part of the brutal response of al-Bashir's regime to the ensuing wave of protests against skyrocketing prices and austerity. Hamoudi's arrest took place last Wednesday afternoon as he participated in a peaceful march in central Khartoum. Now, I think the cliche in a lot of Americans' minds, and it's, again, a product of the corporate media and the educational system here, dominated by capitalism, is that politics in Africa, parts of Asia, South America, it's all sort of some sort of chaos that's always always involved in some sort of shooting and violence and so on. And this is, of course, not true. There's tons of violence in America. It's one of the most violent societies, maybe the most violent society in the world. And in many countries, there are people, of course, fighting out on the streets in a more sophisticated and consistent way than happens here in the United States and other rich capitalist countries. There's obviously, it seems, at least in the short term for some people, there's more at stake in the underdeveloped countries, etc. So don't assume if you hear some country that in the U.S. corporate media is always associated with so-called terrorism or real terrorism or some sort of war, constant warfare, or war between by proxy, you know, from the United States or other imperialist countries or seemingly internal conflicts between warlords and so on. Please understand there's also a what the neoliberals call civil society. I don't like that term really. I would just say there's a society of working class people. In a lot of Middle Eastern countries, for example, a lot of African countries, there were large communist parties, socialist parties that successfully led revolutions against colonialism, started to try to set up socialism unfortunately used a Stalinist model, relied on Russia or China for support that evaporated very quickly, or they found themselves mimicking sort of the Stalinist, again, the Stalinist model internally, and it didn't work out because there wasn't workers' democracy to keep the economy going, or they were isolated, and started to make deals with imperialism. But within those countries that did that shift, or they were repressed and overthrown by U.S. imperialism, for example, Iran, there was a left-wing government elected in 1953 that was overthrown by the CIA, influence of U.S. imperialism, and they put in the Shah of Iran. There's plenty of examples like that. Check out Stephen Kinzer's book, Overthrow, for some examples. There's many, many more. Indonesia, 1965 mainly, huge massacre, almost genocide of communists, ethnic Chinese people, and so on, to solidify the power of a Muslim dictatorship. And in all these countries, not sure about Indonesia because the repression was so horrible, but in many, many countries, there are still communist parties and socialist parties from that time in existence. Now, most of them are going to have Stalinist politics, so they're not going to really go anywhere, but they're still there. And so there's some sort of, at least in some sections of the population, some knowledge of the left or left-wing politics, socialist politics. They haven't disappeared despite the repression. I mean, one reason the Middle East is filled with Muslim dictatorships in a lot of ways is because, whether you're talking about Jordan or Saudi Arabia or Iran, I'm going to throw it all into that basket for a second, is because of the brutal, brutal repression of any sort of socialist or communist movement by imperialism, and then setting up as a counter these capitalist but heavily theocratized states, or groupings. So there's a famous, infamous example of Israel itself promoting the early Israelite state itself promoting the early formation of Hamas, thinking it would take power away from the left, communist, influenced or openly communist and socialist parties. And so, for example, that it would take, power away from the left through religious proselytizing against the left and or actual terror against the left. Well, that actually became true. I'm not saying that Israeli state wanted a terror group, but they wanted, they were thinking, oh, well, if we turn people onto religion, they won't think about socialism and rebellion and so on. Well, that doesn't happen automatically. There has to be a material way to force people away from, their own power as, their own collective power to change things and to retreat to that sort of individualistic, superstitious, religious mindset, to put in the infrastructure for that to really rule, a region and or bring it back more strongly than it has been. For example, in other words, as the communist and socialist parties and left secular movements were gaining popularity in the Middle East in, say, the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, in order to bring back in order to enhance the older infrastructure of Islamic fundamentalism, I mean, that took material, money, and it took resources. It didn't happen overnight. And that, coupled with the repression, the outright repression and murder of socialists and communists, for example, by the Iranian regime and so on. And it's not like, you could be an open socialist in a place like Saudi Arabia or wherever. They created this all of a sudden heavily dominated by right-wing fundamentalist Islam, Muslim groups or groupings, parties, and so on. They created that domination in country after country, and U.S. imperialism used that, right, rode that wave, like for supporting the Saudi dictatorship, for example. But then there's some blowback all of a sudden. Oh, well, the famous or infamous, Al-Qaeda blowback from supporting right-wing fundamentalism in Afghanistan, which is, that blowback, so-called, is still happening today. And no surprise then that, you know, imperialism, thinking it's getting what it wants, ends up getting attacked from a right-wing perspective, a right-wing nationalist perspective. Excuse me. But on the other hand, you have the left. What I'm trying to get is the left was not totally wiped out. And one reason it wasn't totally wiped out is because it, you know, even with a distorted, maybe Stalinist or leftover Stalinist regimes, not regimes, but groups here and there, there are other groups as well that aren't left groups, that aren't, you know, following a Stalinist model or wanting a Stalinist model. But even the ones that do, right, there's a kind of, the ideas they have are kept alive by the obvious failures and repressions of capitalism in those regions. So it's no, you know, you try to bury socialism. They try again and again, and it doesn't work. It doesn't mean that all socialist movements are equal and wonderful and so on. But I'm just saying that the attempts to bury socialism, which have started since the beginnings of capitalism, they fail because capitalism, through creating a working class and exploiting working class, creates the conditions for socialism. Karl Marx one time said, he was asked, well, what is socialism? What is communism? He said, it's the collective experience of the working class. He was really good at, Marx was really good at throwing back the one-liners and challenges. One time someone said at a left-wing meeting, said, hey, how come you're always using these big words? And Marx was like, ignorance never helped anybody. You know, he didn't talk down to people. Also, one time someone said, there was a whole campaign of distortion of some basic Marxist theory around the question of what was known as determinism. Like, Marxism is derived largely from science, in terms of its methodology, in terms of its historical time period. The rise of science was concurrent with the rise of Marxism. It's not accidental. There's a lot of comparison. There's a lot of interlocking threads there. And so Marxism, you know, put forward that people's consciousness, the way they think, excuse me, it doesn't come from some sort of soul, some sort of free-floating ideals or idealism that's somehow not separated from their thinking process, and the thinking process rooted in the material, concrete brain, and the brain's interaction with its environment, with the rest of society, the person's interaction through the use of their brain. And so this is like a revolutionary concept even today, where people will just go. I mean, I was listening to the radio yesterday. There was some folk singer who was taking the stories of veterans and putting them in music. And that was her big inspiration. It sounds good so far, right? But then the way she kept talking about it was like this, like, religious, ridiculous, like, I think I capture the souls of veterans in my songs and so on. Well, there's no soul. I mean, what are you talking about? You know, I mean, this is just ridiculous. And by the way, this is my opinion. You can be as religious as you want and be in the socialist movement. This is my, you know, I mean, I think there's a point where there comes into conflict with the dialectic materialism, the main methodology of Marxism, but there's no prohibition in socialist alternative or other socialist groups that I'm aware of, some of them at least, to religious people being involved. So I'm just doing a thought experiment here, getting, you know, to the point of, you know, you're coming up with all these explanations of why people think, and Marx and Engels and other Marxists, early Marxists and later Marxists and so on, kept reiterating, no, it's people think within certain parameters based on material conditions, how they live, how things are, how good necessary goods and services and things like clothing, food, and so on, how they're produced and reproduced in the system, the time they live in, you know? So you're not going to have socialism in, you know, as a big ideology or big methodology in a slave society where there's no capitalism. There's no big working class. There are slaves, and there's movements for liberation and freedom and so on. But the economic system that would result from that, which did result from the collapse of the slave societies, became feudalism, agrarian-based, etc. That's also based on the technological developments of the time, etc. So anyway, that whole idea of placing human thought not in the realm of religiosity or idealism, but placing it in a material reality of the brain functioning, of influences from the environment, and so on, was then distorted, even by some people on the left, to try to discredit Marx and Engels and other Marxists from the scientific part of socialism, or parts of socialism. And they said, well, you're saying people are basically robots. People are just will do whatever conditions compel them to do. And then what Marx famously said to that, if you're calling that Marxism, I'm not a Marxist. He basically said, no, we're saying there's certain parameters in the production of life and reproduction of life and the way people live under capitalism, forced to sell their labor, etc., that create certain ways of thinking. But they also said, if you read our material, if you follow our methodology of dialectic materialism, an idea can go beyond that in the sense of an idea can take on a concrete material form if it is given concrete material resources. So, for example, someone that's religious would say, well, if religion is not true, what about all the religions? What are they doing? Why are they up and running? And a Marxist would basically say, within the parameters of human thinking, religious thought can emerge, usually out of ignorance of natural processes. For example, why do people die? Why do people get sick? You know, when science is lacking, religion becomes ascendant. But even with science, a lot of things unknown, religion continues. So there's a material basis for those ideas to emerge. But how do they emerge, and how are they propagated in certain standardized ways, or become organizations? Oh, well, wait a minute. Then we could just look and see, well, how many churches or mosques or synagogues have been built? Who paid for them? Who built them? Interesting question. Workers again, right? Selling their labor, etc. Who funds the army of religious proselytizers that dominate street corners in some places, go door to door, go on television and radio, get into the corporate media there. The persistence of religions buying into the corporate media, buying up airwaves, so to speak, and propagating religion through radio, television, etc. Internet, of course. So this all costs money. This all is labor time. This all can be traced to material roots. They used to put Bibles in every hotel room in America. I mean, who printed up the Bibles? Who put them in the drawers? Why did the motel capitalists or small capitalists allow that? That gets into the use of religion under capitalism and other class societies, etc. So there are material reasons for why things happen and why religion is propagated. And that all started because we're talking about briefly the fact that, hey, socialism exists in a place like Sudan. It wasn't killed off. So even in very backward, so-called, in terms of development, parts of the world, the capitalists have neglected to develop, obviously, or they developed from the point of view of pure exploitation, parts of Africa and so on. They are, you would expect, between the repression and the underdevelopment, socialism to basically be not on the cards, not really developing, not really there even, but it is. It is there. It is developing. You won't see it through the corporate media. And in Sudan, there is a new section. There are new supporters of the CWI, Committee for Works International, and there's a man nicknamed Hamoudi, 21-year-old Mohamed Daldin Mohamed Sati, who's been arrested by the Sudanese state, along with many other protests. There's been a wave of protests in that country against skyrocketing inflated prices and austerity. Funny you hear about that happening in Venezuela, but you don't hear about it in the Sudan and many other countries. So anyway, this is an article from socialistworld.net, January 22nd, 2018. Reportedly, more than 400 political activists and protesters are currently detained in the country. That's Sudan, including 9 members of the Political Bureau of the Sudanese Communist Party, leading members of the National Umma Party, and longstanding female activist Ilham Malik Salman Ahmed. This hysterical campaign of mass arrests has extended to include Sudanese and foreign journalists who were reporting about the protests, and highlights the regime's fear that any form of even mild criticism of its policies could be the spark that lit the fuse of a mass revolt. According to protesters who have been released, security services are forcing the detainees to sign a document pledging to stop engaging in any demonstrations or political activities in the future. That's interesting. I've heard that about the Israeli state. They often will try to get people to sign these like documents, even if they're not under arrest, even if they're just like tourists or whatever. They will not participate in protests. That is really sick, in my opinion. Those who have refused to sign, like Hamoudi, have been kept inside the prisons. The prisoners are refused visits by their families. They've had their heads shaved off, and their hair shaved, their heads shaved, and they are being physically mistreated. The CWI, Committee for Workers International, demands the immediate release of Mohamed Sati Hamoudi, along with all the other political prisoners. We call on all our supporters internationally to protest to the Sudanese authorities, embassies, and consulates around the world to that effect. We call on also all those who can to express their solidarity with Hamoudi and other detainees by sending photos and messages of support to CWI at CWI at worldsoc.co.uk. So in other words, information at the CWI website, which is at socialistworld.net. So there are actually pictures with that article of all sorts of CWI groupings in solidarity with CWI doing pictures saying free Hamoudi and so on, and all the political prisoners. I was at a Socialist Alternative conference in Boston yesterday. We did the same thing. We had a big picture taken with the signs. So we hope, if you're interested in that, helping get the political prisoners in Sudan released, you'll check out the story at socialistworld.net from January 22nd, perhaps other stories as well since then or before then, entitled Sudan Free Mohamed Sati and All Political Prisoners. You get a way to write in and help stop that repression. So, as we promised, Me Too and the New Women's Movement, Socialist Alternative is helping to organize around the country rallies that have happened, including the recent Women's March. The one last week that was so big in many cities, we weren't an initiator of that, but we were participants. And in some smaller areas, we were initiating protests and meetings, I think in Ohio, a couple places, and so on. And here in Massachusetts, we're working up to a couple public meetings in Worcester. I'm sure there are meetings in Boston as well. Check out socialistalternative.org. And I've got the Worcester leaflet here in front of me. Worcester, by the way, if you're listening from afar, is a second largest city in New England, believe it or not. It's in Massachusetts, about 45 minutes from Boston, going west. And it's spelled Worcester. It's not Worcester. It's Worcester. Although I hear Woolburn is called the Woo as well. So anyway, whatever. So Social Alternative has a couple branches out in Worcester, and we are having a upcoming meetings. I mentioned earlier, public meetings. Anyone is welcome to come to these. Based at the meeting place itself is at two universities in Worcester, one at Worcester State and one at Clark. Both these meetings are happening Wednesday, February 7th, 2018. Me Too and a New Women's Movement. Also, we're using a leaflet that actually has two sides on it. The other title is Me Too, Socialist Feminism and the Worldwide Women's Struggle. Speaker is Toya Chester, a feminist, socialist, and labor activist. Toya is a member of the union IBEW Local 103. She was also a leading activist for Socialist Shama Sawant's successful re-election campaign to Seattle City Council. Toya will be speaking at Worcester State University and Clark University on Wednesday, February 7th, 2018. Again, at Worcester State University at 2 p.m. at Wesleyan Hall. That's really an interesting name, because usually Wesleyan in New England, but this is Wesleyan, W-A-S-L-E-Y-A-N Hall, Seven Hills Conference Room, Worcester State University, 2 p.m. And as I said earlier in the show, the Worcester State cops are harassing us. Hope that makes people mad. It should. The more we get to this meeting, the more we can get the cops to back off. We even have there's even administrators at Worcester State admitting the Worcester State cops don't like us, meaning Socialist Alternative students that are active at Worcester State, using their supposed rights to free speech and assembly to leaflet and inform people about these public meetings. That's one thing about the United States is the complete hypocrisy about freedom of speech, because quite often there isn't any. And as the old saying, freedom of speech belongs to those who own, freedom of the press belongs to those who own one. Truer than ever. People thought the internet was going to be the big freedom gathering, freedom inducing communication tool. Of course, it takes more than speech. Although speech is extremely important, but it takes more than speech, it takes organization and so on. But let's, you know, just came to the speech level. Well, now you've got the, and it's not just brand new, but you have the control of the internet by the big corporations and by the corporate dominated United States government. So they are limiting access. They are going after left-wing websites, as I mentioned earlier, Facebook canceling Telesur's English page. Many other examples, slowing down, diverting traffic to left-wing websites, including socialistalternative.org, I was told. And this is an outrage. But, you know, you get to a certain level of the working class, and if someone says you can't say something, people aren't surprised, okay? They grew up their whole lives being told in school to shut up and not say certain things, being told in the workplace, of course, to shut up and not say a lot of things. And then maybe going to a town hall meeting or something, or most people don't go to stuff like that, but some sort of political meeting and sponsored by a city council or town hall or something. And look what happens. A couple of weeks ago, a teacher stood up in a meeting in, I think it was Mississippi, started to talk about the school budget, the fact that the powers that be in the school system there were giving themselves big raises. The teachers weren't getting any raises, and there were a lot of problems in the schools that could use more money. And as this teacher is explaining very calmly her position, sitting down, they send a cop after her. Cop drags her out, abuses her. Such an outrage on Facebook and so on, and I helped feed that myself, that they didn't file any charges against her. They even apologized, I think, maybe. I might be conflating that with another story that happened recently. Oh, yeah, the woman being dumped. 21-year-old woman being dumped on the streets of Baltimore, dumped out of a hospital. Hospital dumping, a common occurrence here in the United States because healthcare is run for private profit, if you can imagine that. Can you imagine that? Make a profit off of sick people. I mean, can you imagine? Or rich people's lives are more important than everyone else's lives because they are the only ones that have the health care they need when they want it because it's so expensive, and everybody else has to make decisions about what health care to pursue and what health care not to pursue, or whether to pursue it at all. You know, whether to go into debt, with or without insurance, by the way, to tens of thousands of dollars. You know, from that conference I went to yesterday, there was a woman who is a leading member and organizer for Socialist Alternative, a young woman in the Boston area who went to someone's aid. A woman had cut her leg, an older woman had cut her leg through some sort of accident that this person saw, this person in Socialist Alternative. And the person in Socialist Alternative went to help this woman, and the woman begged her, the woman that was injured begged her not to call an ambulance, saying, "I can't afford an ambulance. I can't afford one. Don't do it." Where's that come from? Well, ambulances now, and this is a fairly recent phenomena, they've been sort of privatized. Well, that's not that recent, but they've been privatized and deregulated to the point where they can just